I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The battle against illegal drugs in Jackson County has been an ongoing fight. 29 years ago, voters approved a combat sales tax that helps manage drug abuse through prevention, treatment, and criminal justice. Today, the new director of the program shares his plans to connect with the community. He'll also tell us how his work relates to Kansas City's violence problem. Then, hear about Kansas's only Indian Nations University. Haskell was founded with only 22 students, but quickly expanded. Despite harsh treatment in the early days, it became a place where students preserved their culture. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Since 1989, Jackson County has been battling illegal drug use and drug-related crime through the combat sales tax. Now a visit with the new director of combat, that's Vince Ortega. We'll ask him for an update on how the war against illegal drugs is going on in Jackson County and what the connection is between those drugs and crime rates. Vince Ortega served for 30 years in the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department before retiring in 2006 as deputy chief. He also served as executive officer to the chief of police and the major over the violent crimes division. County prosecutor Gene Peters Baker appointed Ortega to the combat position late last month. He had served as the program's deputy director. Vince, welcome and congratulations.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Why did you want the job, Vince?
I think I can make a difference. There's some things I want to do, actually a paradigm shift of what we've done.
How so?
I'm looking at being more strategic, more analytical, being data-driven, making sure that our programs are focused in areas that are have the most violence.
So a data-driven approach would mean what, focusing on certain parts of the city when it comes to illegal drug trafficking? Is that what you're talking about?
Not trafficking. I'm looking at violent crime hotspots, where the violent crime occurs. For example, back in 2011, I noticed that our programs were being, when you apply for a program, if you had a good application, mm-hmm. then you were getting funded. Mm. So then I started looking at where these programs were being funded at. And what I saw is some of our area hotspots did not have our programs. So I worked with 11 different police agencies in Jackson County, looked at the violent crime hotspots, worked with our GIS programmers in the county. And right. when they mapped out the crime, there was 18 violent crime hotspots, 8 of those in Kansas City. And the majority of our over 100 treatment and prevention programs were clustered in around different areas, and we had a lot of hotspots without any of our programs.
So these hotspots where violent crime tends to occur, I gather, Vince, you're saying there's a connection between drugs and violent crime that's occurring in those areas?
Correct. We have a violent crime hotspot in South Kansas City in the Ruskin area. We have one in the Northeast area where we're currently concentrating a hub out of Matty Roads mm-hmm. in South Kansas City. It's in the Bethel Family Church. We have one in Raytown. We're working out of the Herndon Center. And then one in Independence working out of the Hawthorne Complex. And what we found commonalities in all those areas is generational poverty, a culture of violence. It's actually a generation. So, and it's a small group. So when you see a violent crime area, there's probably about 30 to 50 families. It's first identified through the youth because of the behavior in school, mm-hmm. and then we track it to the homes. And then that's where we really see the issue. So we're looking at wraparound services.
What does combat bring mm-hmm. to those areas that proves helpful?
First of all, we are going into those areas, coming out of the office, going into the areas, and we're gathering all the stakeholders from the school districts to the police that work in that area, to the business owners, And obviously the residents that live there, and we're asking the questions. We know there's violent crime in here. What is it addressed to? And what we're finding out, some of it's youth gangs, half of it's domestic violence.
Hmm.
And so
you hear that more and more from police officers, that it's domestic violence, that is at the root of so much of the problem here.
And really, the root under all of that is innate mental health or trauma-induced mental health. And so, unfortunately, combat does not provide funding for mental health. Now, we provide funding for treatment. And if you look at it, treatment is really what we're the underlying problem of the addiction is the mental health piece. And so you'll hear the word self-medicating.
Mm-hmm.
So these people, these individuals are dual diagnosed. They have co-occurring issues, and the majority of them are mental health. And so we're going to have to leverage our resources to work with ART, with the Jackson County's Mental Health Levy, to bring those resources in. We're currently working with the Missouri Department of Mental Health and bringing those resources in, because we know that the underlying factor is that.
You know, you get a sense, Vince, as you talk again to law enforcement, social service types, that the community here and really everywhere, we're only beginning to wrap our arms around the notion of just how deep and widespread the mental health scourge is in our community and again, everywhere else.
Exactly. And that really just stood out when coming from law enforcement in 30 years, you get kind of pigeonholed. And then when I went to combat, and I literally visited all our 27 different treatment agencies, talked to the directors, and 90% of the clients that go through there are on probation and parole. You start looking at our jails, the majority of them have mental health issues. So it just stands to reason we have to start there if we're going to make any difference. And it starts at a family. You can't treat a child that's acting out with behavior in school, and then he goes home to this trauma that started it all.
Yeah.
So it's kind of looking at the family, at the whole wraparound services, layers of different services. Because another thing we found out, we have a lot of good programs, but a program has a beginning and end, and it's only hours in a day. It could last 6 weeks, could last 6 months. After that's over, they go back to the trauma that they were induced.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of parts. It's a lot of collaboration. So what we're looking at is more of a comprehensive strategy.
Vince Ortega is my guest. He's the new head of combat in Jackson County. How has the battle against illegal drugs in Jackson County, Vince, changed over the years? I mean, what's different today compared to 15 years ago? Do you have any sense of that?
From what the police are telling us, it's more controlled now, more sophisticated, and it's coming in from the cartel. We used to have...
What is the cartel? From Mexico?
We're actually talking, yes, the Mexican cartel. Mm-hmm. They're setting up in different places in Kansas City. They're business people they don't use. It's business to them. And they're selling those drugs or distributing them to local gangs who distribute. And that's how the violence begins. It's over turf wars. It's over who's selling the best product, unfortunately. So it's been monopolized by the cartel now. And the quantity and quality is skyrocketed. And unfortunately, where you see the fatalities in the mental health, or excuse me, in the drug dealing, is there's fentanyl laced in all of the different drugs that are available.
And remind people what fentanyl is.
Fentanyl is just a drug that is 10 times to 15 times stronger than anything we've seen around in ages. For instance, I was an undercover officer back in the mid-80s, worked there for 3 years. And when we saw cocaine, probably the percentage of that actual cocaine, because it was cut with so many different other substances, was probably 20 to 30%. Now, all that from marijuana to cocaine to meth, it's 100% of that product.
So the challenge is only getting steeper, is what you're saying here. And I'm wondering, you know, given that, should the expectation that the public has for combat, would it be reasonable to say that combat should wipe out illegal drug trafficking in Jackson County? Or are we really talking about placing a lid on it, which sounds like where we're going here?
Well, it's a multi-pronged approach. What law enforcement will do, will take the law enforcement action in a certain area. Working with NOVA, they concentrate on specific hot spot areas. And then what what combat will do, will come in and start trying to find out what the real issues are, and then start working with those families and trying to build those communities and families' capacity and resilience. And really, the only way to do that is, if you remember the old CAN centers, Community Action Network team.
Sure.
There's only two sustained over the 20 years when we originally started. That's the Westside CAN and Ivanhoe. And the reason they were able to sustain themselves, because they have an informal infrastructure that they just partner. They have a number of partners that people in those areas don't call the police. They go right to those facilities, and they can find the resources. And it's a kind of a seamless effort and of services that are provided to them.
So how should the public gauge the effectiveness of an organization like Combat? How do we know if it's working?
That's a good question, because right now the only way we're gauging our success is on the program success. But unfortunately, we've never really been able to show impact in the community. Have we affected the community? We're looking at a program that in and of itself shows that 50% of the clients that went through there were successful, but it doesn't show that those clients were part of the issues in these violent crime hotspots. So we've never been able to show impact. So I'm working with KU professor Jamela Watson Hutt Thompson, who has a $1.7 million grant over 4 years to work in a hotspot in Wyandotte County with specific number of youth that go to a school where they're located. So they're setting up a formal structure, and they're layering services over, realizing that just a program in and of itself does not solve the problem. So I'm working with her to identify community performance indicators that we can measure versus just the program measurements. And so in that, we'll be able to gauge more how effective it is. Right now, we can tell, the only indicator we have, when we started the project in 2015 in Ruskin, we were able to reduce juvenile crime in 18 months by 31%. And this was as a result of the police and the community working together with the school district to identify those families and youth.
You know, when you took the job last month, Vince, you said this: I've learned a great deal in my 9 years at Combat, that reducing crime takes a real partnership that goes far beyond law enforcement. Building community involvement in this effort will be an important key to success. And I'm just wondering, how are you building community involvement here?
We're getting out of the office, going to these hotspots, bringing stakeholders together.
Right.
And we're identifying needs and gaps from the actual stakeholders that live in those areas. In the past, we have relied on our program agencies to come up with programs that they felt and believed would work in those areas. And some, again, weren't in those areas. And the other fallacy is some of our programs. I'm not saying that they're not good, and I'm not saying that we're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but we're going to take a real hard look at some of these programs and see which ones are more effective and which ones we can bring in to these areas. So we're going to be community focused instead of program focused. So we're going on what the community needs rather than what the programs dictate.
Well, if you're going to work with the community, you know, what you hear so much about the police, Vince, and you've heard this about 10,000 times, is that so many members of the community, not everybody, but a lot of members don't trust the police. They don't trust law enforcement. And if that's the case, how will they respond to Combat to be able to build the trust that you need to do the work that you do?
Well, As you see, we fund three pillars. So we fund law enforcement, treatment, and prevention. Well, our law enforcement partners, and when I say law enforcement, that includes the courts, that includes the prosecutor's office. They're out there with us. Jean Peters Baker, we're going to start working on neighborhood. I know she wants to put neighborhood prosecutors out there. So we're working with them. We're working with family court. They have assigned attorneys out to these meetings. We meet monthly and determine, we come up with strategies, implement them, come back monthly to see where we failed, where we need to make some adjustments. So it's a work in progress. In the last 3 years of doing this, Now when we come to a new project, we've already learned a lot of the mistakes in the past, and we're implementing a lot of our factors and issues a lot quicker.
Is it a given? I'm just curious about your own involvement with the police department. How does that play into what you do now for combat?
Well, where I really play into it, because I see now that, and everybody realizes this now, arresting our way out of this is not the issue, because we're not getting to the root cause of the issue. So when I first came in combat, I was able to, and again, we work with 12 different police agencies in Jackson County, and I was able to bring police and our treatment agencies together, because realizing that our treatment agencies, 90% of them are coming from probation and parole, letting them know that a lot of these individuals don't need to be in jail. They need treatment. Mm-hmm. The office, that's why we came up with the crisis center, where the officers don't have to take these individuals that are addicted or strung out on drugs to jail. They can take them straight to the crisis center. They can get immediate treatment and then hopefully counseling after that.
You know, I think so many members of the public hear you describing this and think, okay, this all makes sense. But this community is so hungry, Vince, as you well know, to see a reduction in violent crime, to see the homicide rate go down. And yet it seems like, you know, year after year after year, we sit here on this program out in the community. We talk about programs. We talk about recidivism rates. We talk about treatment programs. And yet the numbers aren't getting any better. And people are just don't know where to turn anymore.
And that's because what I realize, all those agencies are doing good work, but they're all working in silos.
Okay.
And so what we're doing now is bringing them together in small parts of the city that are significantly inundated with violent crime.
And
we're
all talking
about the issues.
And that sounds great, but KC Nova was an attempt to do just what you're talking about. It's years old now, mm-hmm. bringing in federal prosecutors, local prosecutors, drug treatment programs, social services, wraparound services. That was all going to be, that was the rage for several years here. And again, people look at the numbers, if there's a correlation here, the crime numbers, and they ain't seen any difference.
The focused deterrence will always work. So it was law enforcement heavy. That's why Gene was happy to bring combat into the fold, because mm-hmm. now we're working really close with the law enforcement. And we have, like I said, over 100 different programs, prevention and treatment, where the prosecutor's office was limited. They only had a handful of programs. And so they were very, very limited. Again, it's bringing everybody together that was working in silos, looking at the issue and addressing it with, it's a multi-pronged, multi-sector strategy, focusing on small areas at a time. It really starts with working on families, working a block at a time, working a neighborhood at a time to create a safe neighborhood. It's going to take time, but again, it's a paradigm shift.
And it's patience. You're suggesting
absolutely.
It's patience.
And that's
no one out there can wave a magic wand and fix this thing. It's going to take time.
That's correct. And talk about patience. I've been in public safety for 42 years, but I'm still passionate about it because I know we can do this. I think everybody's on the same page now. It's just, how do we connect the dots is really what we're trying to do, because we realize that it's a small group of individuals causing the majority of the problem. If we can concentrate on that, we'll make a difference.
I mean, is it a given, Vince, that violent crime and illegal drugs go hand in hand? I mean, one is a law enforcement issue, one is a healthcare issue. Do they go hand in hand?
Yes.
There's no question about that.
There's no question about that. And that, in fact, that's why in 2010, Combat adopted, or the people voted, that Combat should start funding anti-violence programs. Because not only, if you look at it from a law enforcement lens, you see that violence and drugs go hand in hand because of the carriers, the territory of trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it from the client level, from the user level, we just talked about it. There's always domestic violence involved. There's violence in the home. There's drug abuse, child abuse, and that's what we're seeing. So they definitely go hand in hand. Along with the third part of that is the mental health piece.
Mm. Just to remind our listeners, combat is funded by that sales tax, or a quarter cent sales tax, right?
Yeah.
How much does that raise a year right now?
It varies depending, but we can say safely that it averages about 20 to 24 million annually.
That's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Yeah. And again, your job is to make sure it's being spent in the right places. You think combat's going the right direction right now?
Yes, because like I said, we're community focused instead of program focused. So we're going to make sure that, and we're using data. So where we see the issues are, we're going to focus our funding and our programs in those areas.
Do all big city communities have programs like combat, or is there something unique about Jackson County?
Very unique. We're very fortunate that we have combat. I know, just talking to Jean, there's no way she could handle the amount of work that they have without the combat funds to help support prosecutors. It's the same way with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department.
Yeah. That's Vince Ortega. Again, he's the new head of Combat, the anti-drug group that works in Jackson County. Vince, we sure appreciate you coming in. Good luck with all your work, okay?
I appreciate it. Thanks, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the early history of Haskell Indian University over in Lawrence. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Wednesday's show, we asked if third-party and independent candidates are unrealistic in our two-party system. You can hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the one-act opera opening in Lawrence that explores the issue of driving while black. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. The early history of Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence is one of forced assimilation and persistence. Founded in 1884 as a government-run Indian boarding school, Haskell initially featured an educational system intent on destroying the tribal identity of its native students. As those students pressed on, their experiences and perseverance helped chart a new direction celebrating Native peoples and their culture. Haskell evolved into a leading institute of higher education for American Indians and Alaskan Natives. Historian Eric Anderson will be at the Kansas City Library on Sunday discussing the tumultuous yet formative first 25 years of the university's history, examining its roots, development, curriculum, and student body. He's a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation and professor of history at Haskell's Indigenous and American Indian Studies Department. Eric, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Steve. Great to be with you.
Well, why is the early history of Haskell one of forced assimilation and persistence, as I just mentioned? Tell us about that.
Well, after the Civil War and the closing of the Plains Warfare, a new direction in Indian policy began to take hold. It wasn't an entirely new train of thought, but it was one that became entrenched in the sense of all of the weight of the federal government being put behind it. And what that comprised was a system of boarding schools, off-reservation institutions that were established with the intent to remove young Native children from their familiar surroundings of home and family and language and spirituality and all of those expressions of culture and put them in a place where that would be wiped away, with the thinking being that this forced assimilation would create enough of an impetus in those kids that they wouldn't want to go back to the reservations and they would be integrated.
They were trying to reprogram those kids. Do I have that right?
You have that right. They were trying to essentially take out everything that was Indian about them and replace it with the dress, the language, the thinking of the dominant culture.
And that was devastating on those kids, wasn't it? They were lonely, they were confused, they were away from family. Just awful, right?
Absolutely. It's hard to fathom, I think, for most people. To have your children taken from you, some as young as 3 or 4 years old, to be put into a cold institutional environment where they have, no one to nurture them, to hug them, to hold them, to allay their fears of this foreign environment. And there's a lot of, of course, homesickness and despair, and it's a place of great sadness and great lasting damage, I would say.
And some of those kids actually wound up dying at Haskell. What do we know about that? Because I think you've said that when you drive into the office some days, you pass some of those graves.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever I go to my office each day or leave, my eyes are immediately drawn to that southeast corner of our campus where there are 50-some headstones representing students, children who made the ultimate sacrifice in trying to do something that might bring a better future for their people. They never got to go home. There's a lot of speculation that more children than those headstones represent died there. But those are the ones whose bodies remain on our campus.
I want to just stay with this idea of reprogramming just for a minute more,
sure.
Eric, because there was this model by the 1870s that emerges. It was called the R.H. Pratt and the Carlisle model that involved this phrase, kill the Indian and save the man. What did that mean?
Well, Pratt was a Civil War Army officer, and he had worked with African-American troops during the war. He knew about a school that had been set up for freed people after abolition and or emancipation. And his next experience was in being the warden for Southern Plains warriors who had been imprisoned by the United States government and taken to Florida. He began to see something in them that not a lot of people of his background or of the time saw. He saw Indians as human and educable. Hmm. And so he took a tip from the Samuel Armstrong's Hampton School in Virginia, the one for the freed people, and he convinced the United States government to let him use some abandoned army barracks up in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and then he convinced some of the northern tribes to let him take their children and begin this experiment. And yeah, that was his catchphrase, kill the Indian to save the man. In other words, do away with everything that culturally makes Indians who they are, replace it with those norms of dominant white society. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in his line of thinking, save the person, save the human being. But he saw nothing positive, nothing good in Indian cultures. And if you flip kill the Indian and save the man around, it's really the obverse of, William Tecumseh Sherman's old expression, the only good Indian is a dead one.
And so these kids, their physical appearance would change, their leisure, recreational activities, those things changed. And even when kids would go home then, that process became more difficult.
Sure, yeah. They're exposed to all of these different modes of dress, of behavior, comportment, thinking. Sometimes these children are at a school like Haskell, and by the way, there are about 25 of these large off-reservation boarding schools by 1900. Haskell is the largest. Yeah, so they've been exposed to all of these different things, and the fact is that, and sometimes for years without going home, 5, 6, 7 years, the fact is that most of the students did return back to the reservations, back to their families, and that process of reintegration would have been a very difficult one, would not have been easy at all, and in some cases it really didn't happen. They were now foreigners in their own homes.
Wow.
They no longer spoke the language. They had no connection to the religion. They were something of an oddity. So it's a very sad story in that regard, too, because they didn't fit into the dominant cultural world as Pratt and others had hoped, because there was so much prejudice against them.
Right.
And then going back home, or what Pratt and others call going back to the blanket, that for him was the ultimate betrayal. And but the fact is, they had to live somewhere, and going back home was often a very difficult process as well, the feeling that they didn't fit into either world.
We're talking about their early history of Haskell Indian Nations University over in Lawrence. My guest is Eric Anderson, who will be speaking about the history of Haskell at 2 p.m. Sunday afternoon at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. Well, our listeners will recognize one student who attended Haskell back early on. His name was Jim Thorpe. How did he benefit, or how did he weather the schooling at Haskell? What was his experience like?
Well, most people really do associate Jim Thorpe with Carlisle, and that is in fact where he wound up going and became most famous, kind of emerging as a great football star. Both Carlisle and Haskell had amazing sports teams, particularly football. Thorpe was from Oklahoma, which is the place many tribal nations are located today. He first came to Haskell, but he didn't like it, as a lot of the students didn't, you can imagine. And he revolted against it, as a number of students did, and his revolt was running away from the school and walking back to Oklahoma. His father, as I understand it, wanted him to have this this white man's education. Mm-hmm. He saw some benefit to it, even though it was a difficult process, and so eventually decided to send him to Carlisle, where it would be, of course, too far to walk back to Oklahoma.
How did the children who attended Haskell, how did they get out there to begin with? How did that process of getting kids there, how did that work?
Well, it worked in a number of ways. You would have some parents who, for instance, as I mentioned, Pratt had to go and convince tribal elders. There wasn't a process in place at that time to compel students to go. It was really a rather haphazard process, so it worked in a lot of different ways. One would be those superintendents or administrators actively trying to recruit among the reservations and talking up the benefits or the positives. Mm-hmm. Some children might see it as a possible adventure, and I'm sure that the recruiters tried to put the most, you know, positive spin on it, which would be different from the reality. Then you have other things like Indian agents who are essentially trying to fulfill quotas, and they might use very unscrupulous tactics, say withholding the rations from families until they gave up a child or a couple of children, because this is a time when Indians are essentially wards of the United States government. There's no mobility. They can't leave the reservations. They're very desperate times economically. So agents really control everything, excuse me, including access to food. So they could use tactics like that. Then, of course, there are other more, I guess what you could say, brutal kinds of tactics, forcible removal, you know, actually dragging children out of the, you know, arms of their crying mothers and fathers, just, you know, really awful stuff.
So this early history of Haskell then, you know, Eric, this is really bleak stuff.
Yeah, indeed it is.
But, hard to hear.
Yeah, it is. There's another side to it, though. I think one reason that, and there are again a number of reasons why students might come to the schools or how they got there, but I think there were leaders among the tribes, Red Cloud, for instance, among the Lakotas, or even Geronimo of the Apaches, who saw some benefit to this. And of course, Geronimo was no friend of the United States government. Red Cloud had gone to war against the United States government, but eventually they came to see that the writing was on the wall. The old ways were not going to entirely survive. I think they thought that if their young people could learn from the dominant society, they could get a foothold within it. And I'm certain they probably imagined that those children would retain some of their traditional culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is what happened eventually. It was submerged. You know, we talked about resistance in terms of running away, but there are a lot of other forms of resistance. Students are speaking their languages secretly. They weren't doing it in front of teachers or administrators because they'd get punished. But they were doing it covertly. They were doing their ceremonies covertly, you know, out away from the prying eyes of administration. So there is a story here, too, that is one of triumph, as well as the tragedy that is the more obvious part. And that is cultural persistence and survival. And that is also, too, the gradual transformation of Haskell from this place we call a boarding school. It sounds nice, like you send your kids to Switzerland or something.
Right.
You know, this is a bleak place. And the education is very, very limited in the early days. We're talking primary school, and even that is pretty limited. And the rest of the day, they're out in working on some manual labor trade because the thinking was that Indians aren't smart. They're better with their hands. But eventually, the students are agitating quietly for new types of coursework so that Haskell is becoming a high school by the 1920s. It's becoming a junior college or what we'd call a community college today, you know, by the late 60s, and then eventually transforming to a university that is one celebrating those cultures and those histories of tribal people and their nations from which they come. So there is a story here that has
redemption to it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Well, at what point, when did Haskell begin to embrace the Native American culture and then celebrate it as well? At what point in its history did that occur?
Well, I would say there are inklings of it. Perhaps some might think surprisingly early. One outlet for employment for Native people was within the Indian Service itself, or what we'd call the BIA today. So you begin to have Indian people working within the schools, certainly by the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, and increasingly by the 1910s and 20s. This means then that even though most of them had gone through that assimilation process, they could infuse a place like Haskell with some freeing up of that that harsher, older agenda. So Ella DeLoria, for example, was teaching art at Haskell in the 1920s. She began to integrate Native forms into that art, so it wasn't just Western.
Right.
So there are very small incremental changes taking place. It's a very gradual process.
Hey, Eric, just to wrap up, I read that today there are some 120 to 140 different tribal peoples or nations represented out at Haskell at any given time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just amazing given that the enrollment is roughly 800 students or so.
Yeah, that's an amazing statistic, isn't it? You know, the range of nations that are represented at Haskell is just a wealth of diversity,
right,
in terms of these different cultures, because of our 573 federally recognized tribal nations, they're all different. You know, they all have their own stories, their own languages, their own customs and cultures.
Well, that's Eric Anderson. He's a professor of history at Haskell's Indigenous and American Indian Studies Department. He joined us this morning from Kansas Public Radio. Eric, thanks so much. I sure appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, how Independence, Kansas survived its hospital closing and what it tells us about the future of rural health care. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.